Very good.
I don't have a question.
Yeah.
Say that. There are a lot of new things.
Yeah, three of them. Three of them.
Unless you hit the mute yourself on your computer, I think.
Okay. Any changes, edits, questions? So if there's none, we'll accept it by consent agenda. We are going to review June 22nd, 2026 draft minutes. Edit the addition. If there's none, we will approve the recommendation. Moving on to announcements. Does anyone have an announcement? The council member of the announcement? Any members of the public to announce them? Public comment. This is the time for the public to make comments. Any staff announcements?
Just so that you know, your renewals are still in process. They're currently with the mayor's office, and we'll let you know once we hear back from the mayor's office. I think most of you at this point have already had your meeting with Andre. Andre has reached out to you. Please do respond to him if you haven't had that meeting.
We will hear up general updates from HHS.
Would you like to start?
Yes, please.
Want to start? Okay. Yeah. I'm still on the front, like that's better for our
Yeah.
I realize that I didn't even include here, but should mention next week, many of us in HIV health services, as well as a couple of the co-chairs and Mark, as well as community members, will be at the National All Parts HIV Ryan White Programs Conference. My office will still be staffed. Beth will be there, or will be there remotely. So any questions you can ask. And all right, so with that, I'll go to what's been written. So the first section has to do with updates to staffing of senior leadership of public health, as well as the California Department of Public Health. So the first is, you guys may remember, we have fairly expensive street health services in San Francisco that weren't at one point the health outreach team, which were not located in DPH. I think there was a Department of Emergency Medicine, but don't quote me. Those have now been integrated into DPH. And so they're a section of ambulatory care. So there's kind of parallel to what HIV health services or primary care, jail health services, they have their own line. They sit in ambulatory care. But I think the important part of all that is that they're now part of DPH. So in terms of management staff transition, Roland Pickens, this is within DPH. The director of the San Francisco Health Network is retiring in August. So the health department has two major sections, the health network, which includes two hospitals, and then a population health division where our colleagues in CHEP sit. So the kind of the number two guy is retiring, his name is Roland Pickens. And they're gonna do a national search for that. It's a little sad for us in the sense that he was a huge champion of HIV, really did his best to kind of move our stuff along really rapidly. And it was kind of upper management he wanted to just ask clarifying questions. So I personally will miss him. I think John also will miss him because he was very quick on the turn. So they're doing a national search for his position. So the next person who is retiring in September is Jenny Louie, and she was promoted up from a budget director to the chief operating officer. So she was all of DPH as an operating officer. And actually, it was such a huge position, they're dividing it into two positions. So one is going to be director of operation, and the other is going to be over the DPH budget. So that's the current plan. I don't know if those positions have yet been posted, but they're working on those. Next, Drew Burrell, who was the DPH budget director, reported up to Jenny, did resign in June. He got snatched by Grant Colfax, so he's working over at his remember Grant, who our former director. So Kelly Kirkpatrick, she's been appointed as the acting director of the budget for SFDPH. So I promise I'm going to stop soon. So that's that for the retirements and upper executive management, that's it. And then Dr. Tyler Maines has been promoted to director of DPH Jail Health Services. So those of you who remember Lisa Pack, they'll be replacing her. And then a new person coming in is Kathleen Johnson-Silk. She is the director of the street homeless program that I just mentioned. So she'll be a new person, and maybe you guys will eventually want to invite her to come and speak. So California Department of Public Health, good news, Dr. Marissa Ramos has been promoted from the chief of the AIDS office to now the chief for the Center for Infectious Diseases. But chief of infectious diseases to the syndemic division. So that's very good. So switching gears now to talk a little bit about HIV, just in terms of general updates. So you guys know we finally got our complete award notices for A, B, C, E, H, E. Then we also know our general fund levels, including now the cost of doing business. That's the additional money an agency gets each year to keep costs, to keep up with inflation. So we're doing award letters and contract renewals. So if you talk to John Ainsley, please send him hugs and kisses because it's a big job he's doing for us. Just to kind of remind folks, I talked about this a little bit ago. We are looking at changing around which funds each program is on in response to the executive order. So that's what President Trump put forward that doesn't help through DEI stuff, doesn't align through gender ideology stuff that's focused on trans people or people of color where that's obvious in the name. Runs a risk of being defunded, and I'll talk more about that. So what we're doing is kind of shifting. The other things you guys know, we're going to keep getting reductions in Part A because they changed the formula. So you guys remember, it used to be resident, where you were diagnosed, where the money stayed, now it's where you currently live when you're HIV positive. So San Francisco is going to be decreasing. So what used to be Part A money in the feds is now Part B money, so dying by. So all this means is we're going to be trying to figure out the right way to shift around contracts. And then on top of that, we're trying to get people down to one or two funding sources because it's just a bear to manage. They're called exhibits in a contract and and agencies changed over too. So we spend a lot of time with education. So, just for you guys to know, we will be moving some of the funds, the total dollar amounts by the service categories that you guys prioritize and allocate won't change. And if anyone has any questions or concerns, let us know. But the general principle is we got less Part A, we got more Part B, and we want to protect agencies that are focused on African Americans, Latinos, trans people, Asian Pacific Islanders. So stuff where the name is there in big bright letters, we're going to try and move them onto general fund. So I think I should stop to see if anyone has a question on that. Any questions, concerns? So I'll move on. We've also started our contract monitoring. So every year we DPH does a pretty extensive monitoring of all the programs we fund. It's not just HIV or CHAP, it's all the programs. Please do. For folks listening, are you hearing me okay? Is my volume good? I should have checked before.
I don't think it's you, it might be the computer.
Okay. Can they hear me, Mark, or is
not very well.
It's just Richard, that's on the other end.
Yeah.
Richard, would it be better if I spoke up more? Or is it something else?
How's that, Richard?
I can't really hear and listen. I can just put the phone to my ear. That's fine.
Are you sure, Richard? Does it work better if I talk louder like this?
No, don't put yourself forward. I'm only going to stay around an hour. I'm just listening like a transistor to my ear. It's fine.
You sure? Okay, well, just say something if it's not, okay?
Thank you. And the whole bill.
Okay, and I know you know how to read, so it's there.
Thank you.
Okay. I wasn't mad at that, sorry. So the monitoring cycle. So it's pretty extensive. They have to put a bunch of information into a file system, which then gets reviewed. And then people go out in teams, and they look at everything from personnel files to client files, and they ask a whole bunch of questions. And we, for the most part, go hit them with our giant team of eight. So all of anything that's the Ryan White or EHE funded, and we also go to select general fund programs. And it's one just, it, so one, it's not my gotcha moment, but it's making sure everything is ticked and tied. And we are especially want to do that because everything now goes in front of the, it's large enough, it goes in front of the Board of Supervisors, but it goes in front of the Health Commission. Anytime there's a renewal or it gets over a certain dollar amount, and we want them to be like as picture perfect as possible, so there's not questions about performance. So this is not a fun time for the agencies, but we do our best that it's also, you know, information sharing. We learn a lot from what's going on and hopefully getting them looking good. And, or if they're doing crappy, to find out why and push them in the right direction. Okay, so it'll be the next several months we'll be doing that. Get the next one? Okay. So moving along. Notice I did not put that in exactly the next one. No. But on a serious note, you guys, I also am turning 62 and been at this business about 37 years. So I am planning to retire in November, unless something radically changes, in which case I could stay a little longer. But I'm excited to not be on schedule. But it has nothing to do with the work itself. I really have loved this work. I love working with you guys. I have the world's best team, well, maybe not the world's best, but the best in all of DPH. And I know that I'm growing, that's obnoxious, but I still say it. So you guys are gonna be in very good hands. I'm excited to see Bette Leary will be in the acting director position. And I'm imagining will eventually become permanent, but you'll be in very good hands with her. They're smaller than mine, but track detail like nobody's business. So, you know, definitely believes a lot in the planning council too. And she is perhaps an even bigger champion than I am. So I'm really by that, but also a great team that you didn't mention. So I'm going to keep shuffling along in respect to Rock and Anders, as Fifth said. So we do have our next CQI meeting. We just had one last time. It was held the second week of July, and we'll have another one in October. Excitedly, Dr. Olivia Hansen was recently hired by CHEP to do HIV prevention integration into all the BPH clinics, and specifically focused on monitoring injectables for PrEP, so for prevention stuff. But I imagine we'll be anchoring lots of other stuff too. And she seems young and energetic and came to the meeting even before she officially started in her role. So I think it's a great sign. Looking forward to seeing what she brings. I'll make this invitation again. It's at Lucky 3, Lucky 7. You guys are welcome to come to a CQI meeting. There is no obligation. They're all virtual. You can kind of see how we do CQI. The two areas that we focus on are Black, African American, which for us now is the watch metric. So that means there was a disparity. We reduce the disparity on to almost nothing or statistically not significant. And then it's popped up just a tiny bit. So we continue to watch it to make sure it doesn't happen again. And the big focus, of course, is people experiencing housing instability or homelessness, which is, you know, the greatest predictor of being non-violent. That's it, kind of fixed out every other kind of way we look at it. So again, if you want to go, the next meeting is October 8th, and just give Beth a shout, and you could also hear about it. Also, you can get Nathalie on a break, and she can tell you about it. We really would welcome. You can just listen quietly, you ask questions, share an opinion, you can get screened beforehand if you want to know more, just ask questions about what it's about. Okay. The last one is not fun, and I'm going to do it kind of in the spirit of not going through every painful sentence on this, And really talked about like where the pushback is coming. So the Trump administration, through the White House Office of Management and Budget, is trying to push through the House and the Senate the implementation of a new rule, which is called the Regulation for Federal Assistance, which is a ban. So what it does is it essentially gives a ton of power over the Office of Management and Budget, as well as the agencies that are funded, to have a tremendous amount of control over how grants are given out, who's eligible, who's ineligible. And it's not just HIV. In fact, it's kind of amazing to see the outcry from the scientists, so people that are getting grants from NIH and stuff, but it's still very much in the middle of the fight. So I'm just gonna call just a few of them. It allows them to use a kind of tougher guidance on all of grants, which really kind of limits our ability and really kind of gives force and teeth more to the executive orders I talked about earlier. And then there's some kind of creepy stuff like aligning with administration policies and priorities, which is very ill-defined. So whatever the president thinks should be the direction that grants go in, it kind of says that's the goal. And by extension, those that don't align with those values or directions would not be funded or cease to be funded. It would expand the free issuance review by senior political appointees, which would be exactly that point, ensuring that it aligns with the presidential vision. You can kind of see the priorities he's looking at, the elimination of racial preferences or proxies for race, the denial of the sex binary in humans would be a cause for it's not being funded, illegal immigration, or any other initiatives that somehow fit this in. So it does broaden the federal authority to terminate awards based on political priorities and set in government wide conditions on federal funding. So, and then again, I'll look at quicker at this point because I think you got the flavor. Focused on diversity, inclusion, equity and inclusion, and then gender ideology. So you can see kind of, I'm going to skip the rest because again, I don't want to have to give out, select that. So these are the potential impacts. So you can kind of see below on that bullet, which I think people can just kind of figure out from what's outlined in the policy. So I wanted to talk about the kind of what's where we're currently at, the next steps. So the part of the process to introduce before you implement a rule is you have to have a public comment period. So they receive just about 500,000 responses, and the overwhelming majority of those were people who were against it. And apparently the ones for it were a smaller groups of people that just use the same form letter over and over again, which in a way doesn't help the case for the people that want this because it's one response for a topical area. So if people did individualized letters, it means a lot more work for OMG. There is bipartisan pushback in both houses of Congress. I think kind of we'll see where, you know, different reasons, probably the Republicans more want to curtail some of it rather than not implement it. And the city and county of San Francisco, the city attorneys gather stuff from all the different departments in the city and county, over 40 of them, that has written kind of a legal response, which will likely feed into the, you know, the Office of Management and Budget could either to rescind, delay, or implement it. And if they implement it, then the next thing will go into the courts, and then the courts will determine the legality. So for those of you that did write, thank you for doing that. And of course, we'll keep you updated on it. So I'll ask if there's questions, and I'll also ask Laura if you want to add anything, if I missed anything you think is said.
Thank you. I have many opinions, feelings. It's a sort of sad. This is where the federal administration goes with all of this stuff, but they can try to insist on the funding areas that they want. That doesn't make it real. So And it, you know, the other thing that is happening is that there are a number of organizations, including three organizations here in San Francisco, that are suing the Trump administration over related things, and so created some protect funds for some of the nonprofits. And there have been other lawsuits, some of which, many of which, the city attorney has signed on to or done, you know, supportive briefs. So, you know, but it is also clear that the, you know, many of these things, that they make it to the Supreme Court, then they fall in line with the administration anyway. So the legal protections through the court seem to be sort of temporary, I think. And yeah, you know, it's always worth pushing back on these things just because it's important to. But I think, you know, we're also, and I don't know if Chuck's going to mention this, but there's also currently effort underway to cut a number of HIV prevention grants at the federal level, including ones that come to SFAF and SCHC. So yeah, all directly funded community-based organizations that are, you know, very much.
I think the other potential remediation, of course, is that laws get made by the Congress and the Senate. So we'll see what happens in the midterms and how that may or may not impact it. So, but there's a lot that's unknown, a lot to be concerned about, but I don't think this is a priori accomplished. I think it's very much a battle.
Yeah.
Anyone have any questions or thoughts on that? Anything else? Okay, thank you guys.
Let me know if you cannot hear me, Richard. So Laura, the CDC directly funded this in the Megatrends presentation later on this evening. So
Ash is a Megatrend now.
Oh, big trend, unfortunately. So just to acknowledge that our wishes team did an overdose nursing training on the Many Hands Day. So the people that had a caring number of folks with regard to the making sure folks understood how to use Narcan and some care training. We have an onboard SF event. We did this last year, specifically focusing at the workforce and us trying to stand up and support community-based organizations with large turnover of workforce of employees, basically, that's happening over the last few years just due to the fact that the landscape has been so dynamic. And so that event will be on August 11th at the Olympic Peace Center. Folks have staff that might be interested or kind of newer to the workforce, which usually are our intended audience from the standpoint of folks who don't get the opportunity to kind of see a network at work, and they're just kind of in their job and doing their direct service work all day. So that's really kind of the audience we'll kind of reach, to make sure that they have access to additional education and also just the ability to who else is doing similar work within the community. Regarding to HIV, and the early prevention activities. So the flyers are in front of you. There are some of them on the table, so I encourage folks to sign up. The HRTI, Harm Reduction Training Institute, has been renamed due to the fact that the term harm reduction is basically we've been asked to scale back the usage of that particular term. And so the new terminology is Health and Recovery Training Institute. So I'll talk more about that in the Megatrends presentation as well. And then our Advocate Sex campaign, there's just various activities listed there that are happening over the next month. And that particular campaign is what has an intent to reach Jane Black, you know, individuals that are at higher risk for HIV CSDIs. I did not put it on here, but I want to acknowledge that Derek and I joined Anna for San Mateo. We'll the
advisory board.
The advisory board with regard to the funding process. And I just want to develop on the process. Staff seem really engaged. The community folks seem really engaged in the vibe, for lack of a better word, is usually how I kind of get by. Was healthy, and it was really nice to see. So I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to kind of show up and just also acknowledge any of your new in the role kind of thing. Instead of seeing that settled in and it's going in a nice direction, it's, I wanted to make sure I shared that experience out with all of you.
Thank you, Tom. We're going to hear an update from CARE, from Jewel.
Hi, everyone. So on July 21st, the House of Representatives passed.
I just had a question on how do you do the world one quarter census.
Yeah, there's a barcode on the flyer. Oh, right there, Freddie. No, that's right. If you are.
Thank you.
No.
Thank you.
All right.
Go ahead.
So I'm going to give an appropriations update, and Bill's going to give a care update. On July 21st, the House of Representatives passed a hearing resolution that's going to extend funding levels for all federal agency programming through the fall, and this will avoid a government shutdown. This will extend through December 4th, which is going to give lawmakers an opportunity to give them more time to pass the fiscal year 2027 budget. And I think that's the biggest. The biggest thing that I have to say along with corporations. There's been a lot of things going on with CARE.
Yes. More structural things going on with CARE. So CARE is the community of emergency, business
relief.
AIDS relief. Community
and emergency AIDS relief.
That's quiet. Very quiet.
Quiet. That's not so.
I mean, there is some really annoying.
It really is.
I call it the Scandinavian. flyer restructure. You guys know that I was the chair. It's the restructure looks like new leadership. A large CEO in Atlanta is going to be taking over kind of the fiscal parts of it. And it's going to be a shift to a lot more hybrid meetings and more non-person meetings, because with the restrictions of the funding, all none of the Part A providers, or even the biggest one, the largest CNAs, have the funding to go, although the larger unions are going to continue the financial support through membership, so it's an attempt to kind of expand that. Our extraordinary administrator, Peg, he is also retiring for health patients, so we are very sorry to see her go, but we're in the process of absorbing her duties, and we're hiring new consultants to do a lot of this work that hopefully should be able to join us as a high level consultant. The amazing amount of work she does. But we are continuing with Karen Fox, who pro bono at no charge does our policy updates, and this kind of amazing job. They're kind of a very well-connected policy and advocacy consultant kind of group. And most of them might be both teams, so they have both Republicans as well as Democratic kind of connections, and they get kind of the best intelligence they can of forming the legislation and what's going on in Oval before actual laws are finalized. So we're fortunate that they will continue to do that. And we are going to continue to partner with NAGO, which is community and health organization, so it's a national organization. And we'll continue to we do a few different things with that. One is we have these every 2 months they call center policy updates, which are with all Part A recipients, and sometimes we can see folks and sometimes community folks there as well. Which is becoming increasingly important because the staff at First Avenue, this is my comment afterwards. People like that way, you know, they have to be very careful how they interface with the community. So, this is really a way that working to give that input as to kind of what's working well and what's not working well. And thankfully, they have a start that follows the staff. So, probably they can say that, but at least to know what's really happening on the ground. So we're able to have even non-edited version if we get that. So when we meet with him, I'm excited to see that continue. Also looking at elections for new members. So stepping into that role, I may stay on as a co-chair in case it takes a while to have some votes. Those are the plans for home care. And I'm looking forward to next year, particularly as we do more virtual visits to see how that goes. And hopefully, we'll be in position for the guidance.
Thank you, Bob. Okay, we're going to move then to the committee needs assessment report.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am Mike Zog from DAS. My colleague Paul Salta is here. We are from the Office of Community Partnerships, which is essentially just a unit within DAS that does most of the work between the department and community-based organizations. I sent out a lot of materials that I think I saw get emailed out. We've got, we're talking today about our community needs assessment report. So I sent out the report. There's also the appendices attached to it, which is another big long document, but has lots of good information if you want to dig in there. It has a lot about the department, a lot about the different services we provide. It's got a breakdown of all the kind of questions we ask during our survey process, and lots of details in there. You can read a couple pages here and there, or look at it in the future if the department ever comes up. I find it a good resource. I also sent a big long slide deck that's got, I don't know, 50 slides. We're gonna try to get through maybe 25 today and see where that gets us. What we're going to do, we'll talk about the background and why we do this and how we did our needs assessment. We're going to run through some of the major findings, the top 10 or so findings from our needs assessment. We're going to see where people living with HIV kind of popped up on our radar explicitly along the way. I think when we get done with that, maybe I'm going to have the first question, and I want folks to just kind of sit with our findings and say, hey, does that resonate with me? Does that make sense? As a member of the community, as a member of this council, are there things that aren't showing up on here that we should have heard about? And then we'll do questions. Okay, so let's get started here. Okay, I already talked about that. Why do we do this? Look, in a nutshell, we have to do this every 4 years. We do this big assessment process that takes us more or less a full fiscal year to do. It's part of, the department has a voter pass set aside called the Dignity Fund. There's city legislation around that. And as part of our responsibilities for that funding, we just have to do this process. We also use it to meet our requirements for the Older Americans Act, which is federal funding that we receive. I would imagine you guys probably do. There's always some rough parallels between Older Americans Act and Ryan White funding. So I would imagine you do some regular needs assessment sort of processes every year as well. Hopefully same idea. We do it every 4 years. We got this done last fiscal year. This fiscal year we take this report, and we build it into another report called the Services Allocation Plan. That's us starting to figure out how much money we want to invest in which kind of service areas. It gives us a more rigid framework to try to meet the needs that we identified. Okay, so there are sort of three research questions that we do with our needs assessment. What are the needs of older adults and adults with disabilities? What are system level strengths and gaps, and what population subgroups need to be underserved? As a reminder, older adult in the DOS world is defined as 60 and over. That is following the Older Americans Act. Unfortunately, there are many, I'm sure you're getting this, there are many different federal standards as to what is an older adult. We use 60. Adult with a disability, for us, is 18 to 59. Disability, we have a very low bar for definition of disability. Okay, our methodology. How did we go about this research project? We did community surveys pretty straightforward, fill out a survey. Community forums, focus groups. We had a meeting with service providers, and then we did something called an equity analysis. This was sort of an academic review of demographic trends in the city and population size. And then we compared that to our service data of who we serve. We had a tremendous amount of community feedback through this process, which was really incredible. So our surveys, we got close to 6,500 surveys completed. The breakdown on that is actually we got about 4,000 surveys, which we call convenience surveys. This is surveys where we went out to community providers and said, hey, can you get your folks to fill this out? We checked in with community groups, came here, I made a pitch, hey, everyone fill this out. We ended up with 4,000 surveys that way. We also ended up with 2,000 random surveys. So we mailed out 25,000 surveys. We all sent them back. We got about 2,000 back, which we were thinking we'd only get a couple hundred. So we were very excited to get over 2,000. And then 290 were in the service provider category. When people were filling out their surveys, if they identified as a service provider, someone working in community serving the population, their survey was a little bit different. Community forums. We went out to every district in the city, plus one virtual forum, and we hosted this event that they usually ran for a couple of hours. And we had pretty good attendance. That we had like a facilitator. We break up into groups and you know, go through a series of questions with each of those. Then we did focus groups. These were more intense studies on specific populations in the city. These were capped at 15 people. What did we do? 14 of those. You can see some of the different groups we focused on. Shout out to the AIDS Foundation and specifically Vince Chrysostomo, who was like, let's do this, and hosted one on focusing on people with HIV and rounded up people real quick to get that together. Okay, now let's go into what did we learn from all of this work. So I'll go through, I think there's 10, and I'll kind of just maybe do a little blurb on each one of them. So the first one is that, I can't see the top, older adults have various needs as they age. I think the finding here I wanted to highlight is that we found that service-connected older adults tend to have higher needs than non-service-connected older adults. And this is comparing that convenience sample, so folks that were already in the system receiving services tended to say that they had higher needs or gaps in needs than the random survey that we sent out. Kind of looking at what we heard back from those folks, we had some consistency across kind of the top needs. Getting enough physical activity, using technology, getting legal help, getting enough social contact and social connection, and getting medical service. And I want to just, that's fantastic.
Okay, cool.
And I just want to say, you know, medical services was a little bit nuanced in that it wasn't necessarily about, I can't get, well, it was more about, I don't have a regular primary care doctor. I don't have someone that I interact with regularly. I'm not comfortable in the medical system. I don't trust it. So it's a little more nuanced than just straight up accessing services. Now I won't advance. Oh, there we go, got it. We found that adults with disabilities, again, this is folks 18 to 59, face significant barriers to participation in services. And we, you know, this is a known issue for DOS, Disability and Aging Services, that we are pretty good at reaching people 60 and over, but we have a lot of work to do in reaching people 18 to 59. And so that is, this is just continuing. We're seeing within that group, we're seeing lower levels of participation in our services, as well as higher levels of needs identified. And some of the needs identified, the top needs within the adults with disability category, we saw legal help, mental health support, physical activity, getting enough healthy food, and affording rent or board. Stuff. Okay, affordability came up. I think this is something that is very in the moment. I think that the thing I want to highlight here is social safety net programs provide essential, but even still insufficient support. I think we have a couple of quotes here. You know, this is again, I think the themes here is just, you know, I'm on GA and food stamps, but that's just not enough to get me by. Okay, social connection. Social connection is important. People want social connection. We know that there's evolving science, or it's always been there, science saying that people are socially connected, have this sort of plethora of health and wellness benefits tied to that. People love, people who are going to community centers or who are participating in different programs and groups tend to really enjoy them and really highlight the value of them in their life through this process. And again, we got some quotes, you know, something about funding for social hour. You know, we had in our Native American group, someone had mentioned an American Indian Arts workshop, which I think had closed many years ago, and they still thought, you know, remembered back on that. Their own enjoyment of going to that space, but also that it's a space that the community was utilizing for various functions. Okay, consumers have unmet needs related to mobility, transportation, and safety, which limit full participation in public life. There's kind of a number in here, a number of different things in here, people feeling disrespected or unsafe out of the public, particularly older adults, but also the idea that the concentration of services tends to be in the downtown civic center area. And we hear often from folks in the west side of the city, out towards Park Merced, you know, south, you know, the sort of the District 11 area, that there's just not as many resources, and they're often having to travel. And when you have to travel, that just exacerbates all those other things about access to transportation, feeling safe, things like that. People don't know what people and providers don't know the full array of services that are out there. And then they don't know how to best promote themselves or their clients get into like the service or the service. This is something that this came up in our 2022 survey. So this is just kind of a known issue. And it's something that we are trying a number of different efforts about. We've just launched an online resource directory that I think is in soft launch mode, but may get some more attention soon as we try to come up with different strategies to break down that knowledge gap and that knowledge barrier. Okay, this is a quote about, there's all kinds of stuff out there. We don't know what it is. We need to do the paperwork. Okay, here's a couple interesting ones. People with DOS, when we look at our services, we statistically do a pretty good job reaching people of color and people with limited English proficiency. But within these groups, there are still high levels of need. There are still gaps. These populations identify high needs and high barriers to service. Here's a really interesting one as well. That's a little bit of the opposite. We underserve LGBTQ populations. Statistically, they are underrepresented in our services. At that same time, populations in LGBTQ consumers in our survey were sort of on par with other folks about need levels. So it wasn't necessarily a high rural need, but it is that we're not reaching these populations as well as we could be. This is the primary place where people living with HIV pops up. And so a common theme we heard is that people living with HIV can feel invisible and deprioritized within services, but that appreciate providers who understand and serve them well. This is sort of hard to all follow, but I would say that I think maybe a way to illustrate the underservice of population, LGBTQ populations in DOS is that roughly, there's a couple of different ways to slice it, but anywhere between 15 to 20% of the population in San Francisco is identifying as LGBTQ. But when we look at our population we serve, it's often between 7 and 10%. The populations that we serve. So we are, this is a red flag for us. Caregivers. So caregivers are folks taking care of a dependent older adult, a dependent spouse, a dependent child. They are stressed out. They need support. They need help doing what they're doing. This is often ways to do this are through typical interventions are kind of counseling and support services, vouchers to bring in paid caregivers so that you can go out for the day and live your life. And then training around how to effectively and safely do your job as a caregiver. So kind of here's some of the survey results for caregivers. And you see that I think that roughly about half of caregivers, at least once a week, if not more, are worried about emotional stress, financial stress, and physical stress. Okay, last one, veterans. Veterans face barriers to participation, especially related to service awareness and navigation. I think veterans, another population that in theory has its own kind of service channels, but I think perhaps there's some siloing that occurs there. And DOS, while we have veteran-focused programs, veterans, of course, are welcome across across our services. So this is something we're keeping an eye on as well. Okay. We got through our top 10. I'm going to stop for a second. I've been running and rambling, talking a lot here. Okay, we got through our 10. What do folks think? Anything resonate? Yay, nay? What about this?
I thought it was a great report. What I would love to hear about is stigma.
Okay.
HIV stigma and also discrimination.
Okay.
Like, how does that affect care and access?
Yeah, well, I think we're interpreting this as meaning that
And I say that because the HIV community over 50 is the population right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's going to retire and utilizing these services.
And we're seeing what I think the primary thing that we got is just sort of a perhaps like an invisibility or an ignorance around those issues, but not we didn't necessarily pick up anything as far as discrimination or anything like that. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it's a fair statement, but it's a missing statement.
Okay. Yeah.
But I just want to say, so Michael actually uses an intro. Michael is going to be assuming leadership of AICHA, which is an interdepartmental in the city and county. It's going to be three different agencies looking at the issue of HIV and aging. And one of the things that did get raised was just kind of, if you look at a lot of the literature, people are going back in the closet about their sexuality and their HIV status as they enter into aging systems. So we've talked about kind of moving to go from being an accepting place and proactively place that announces itself as receptive to LGBTQ folks, racial and hard folks. Because you also have a number of women that are engaging, that's but they're not necessarily the main. So, so I think that's some of the things that we have, at least in the past, discussed, and particularly agencies most likely we see LGBT folks in them. So, kind of might want to say a bit more about that.
Thank you.
Sure. Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah, it's just that we're actually looking at the connection.
Yeah, that is a big thing that these employers should be. We look at it in this group. And they also contributed to the HIV and aging symposium that we had.
Thank you.
So, I had a quick question. So, is there a set list of questions that people could ask across the board for all agencies under DAS to address food insecurity, transportation, all these things that people may not know about? Because I know that there's some agencies that do have these things set up, or anything that they do, they have a set of questions about all the different stuff that group may respond.
It's not very uniform. I think we have programs like our Aging and Disability Resource Centers, who their whole job is to kind of do an assessment, figure out what's going on. Our case managers go through a set assessment, but that's going to be where you're only going to get that uniform kind of universal approach. In our nutrition programs, we are checking about food security and things like that. In some of our community services, we might be checking about social isolation, but ultimately it's only a subset.
Okay. And then how much funding does the last section spend on health care? Well, when we know that we represent about 17%.
Yes.
We serve in 5%.
Yeah, that is a great question, and that is something that I could get. Apology. Our budget is about $100 million a year to community-based grants. We partner with many LGBTQ-focused or LGBTQ-competent organizations. So
I think you could define LGBT-focused specifically and then serving LGBT.
So, yeah.
Because that's going to be a totally different.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, thank you for the presentation. Well, I have two things.
Sure.
One is for the average LGBT experience to the services class. Coming out in one of the service communities can be a difficult thing because they're also coming out to people of the same age that have grown up in a culture where being an LGBT plus individual is not something that was readily accepted or acceptable. So there's going to need to be a certain amount of education for that community. And does DAS have the ability to provide the education necessary to normalize that LGBTQ person so that they are welcomed into that community? And then when you add the stigma of HIV on top of an already marginalized group, does DAS have the educational ability to then explain that you do not get HIV from sitting next to an individual or sharing a drink or silverware or the same bathroom?
So you bring up a lot of great points. So we have had, and for at least a decade, if not longer, multiple projects to train our grantees to make sure that, you know, regardless of who you're, what neighborhood or what focus you're on, what population you need to be focused on, that you are creating a welcome and inclusive space for all. So we've worked closely with Open House around, we've had a training on cultural humility and those concepts, as well as sexual orientation and gender identity, kind of at the, when that kind of became like a data requirement. We've been, those have been in place for, I think, a decade, if not more. And from time to time, those are required trainings for our entire group to go through. We also work with the Alzheimer's Association, who developed a training around what they're calling LGBTQ dementia care. So this is really more about the facilities, health facilities, and destigmatizing, allowing people to be LGBTQ in places where they are there for dementia care, more medical centered places.
You help the staff,
it's the other.
It is the other participant. And it's a, it needs to be an ongoing, because you may have someone new to the program.
Mm-hmm.
Are there literature? Are there problems that are done a couple of times a month? Skips done, reminding people.
Okay.
What types of things to keep the other residents that may have problems with memory? They not remember to talk about this, because many people are not, when they're tolerant, they're not reminded. The LGBTQ people are put at risk, and particularly when you add the element of HIV on top of it, then that becomes a greater threat to them. And that's coming to the programs, they may see the programs actually as a threat to their personal safety. Because if you can't guarantee that safety as a safe space for them to be in, they're not going to come unless it is a last resort. I'm just throwing that out there.
No, no, no. I'm grabbing it tonight and putting it in the knowledge.
Yeah, this is really important information. I appreciate your hearing. You're being here too, and I think these statistics are extremely important, and we need to continue evaluating just what the size of the population is. Because the every reports that we're receiving is our senior HIV population is expanding.
Yes,
we're ending up with this really, you know, graph that looks really exaggerated at the sense where seniors are in HIV care. So these statistics are important to help you keep them up so you can really gauge what's really going on with the HIV senior population under your care.
And I think in San Francisco, we're operating on the idea that 70% or about 11,000 people living with HIV in San Francisco are ages 50 and over. And we do not need to be.
Yeah.
Paying attention. And I believe within the within the HRSA Ryan White world, I think older adults starts to
You know, I hate to use the word silent, but as a start, have you never thought of setting up a program in the adults for the HIV aging population, and then for we sort of like letting the fish out into the water, so letting them go into the other group, so it's not one at a time. But it is, as I say to yourself, safety in numbers. So that there are groups of people being able to bid join the other.
Okay, I like this, yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of connected with what I think Ed is trying to say, something about cultural community. There was a set standard of things cross dots that were asked. Like the fact that you're asking about food security in a food program seems ridiculous to him. Like obviously, but there is food insecurity. You should be asking about social isolation. You know, there's certain programs that I see people that have no connection to what the food is for, but they're just kind of looking for food. And until they get a referral to a food source, then you know they keep doing what they need to do.
Okay.
And if you have that, you know, socialization, mental health, food insecurity, housing, then as a basis and cultural humility as an intake for all the clients across DOPS, then you would start bringing some parity across the whole board. And then I just want to bring you back to the 14 community forums, because I know I reached out to you about
yes.
this. I reached out to you about it personally also because Happen Leadership asked me to reach out and Hans Leadership asked me to reach out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DOPS is saying they want to make sure that they take care of LGBT people, but they didn't have a community forum in the Castro.
Yes.
Okay. And having one of the missions focused on Spanish and Cantonese speaking people, you know, if you're saying you want to meet the needs of LGBT, you can buy your DOS. You need to show up for people.
Yeah. Yes.
And not doing that, it just it's kind of a slap in the face.
Okay. Okay. I don't disagree with you. I will agree with you. I will cautiously attempt to take down from slap in the face. I'll say that we do this every 4 years. We do one in each district. And then this time we made the decision for District 8 to go to the other end of the district and do, you know, down at the like Glen Park kind of Mission, Noe Valley end of it. We missed an opportunity here. I think we did one in 2022. You're going to be in top of mind when we schedule, when we come back. And then my only like kind of defense, this is a little defensive, but we did take time to really have multiple focus groups that were really a more focused opportunity, including I think we went and we did TGNC, TGNCI, sexual minorities, people living with HIV, a couple different deeper dives that other populations maybe give that level.
Yeah, I just, you know, I appreciate that. I'm just going to say, like, you noticed that the western part or the southern part of it, that district has completely different needs and population than, say, the Castro part or the Mission part.
We only have 3 more minutes left, so if we can continue with the presentation.
You got it. And I only had a couple slides left. They were basically like.
So maybe you can take questions from them during the break.
Okay, you got it. Slides here real quick, and then we'll be done. Okay, what do we do with all of this? So we take this report. This report was issued, I think, in April of this year. We take it out, we socialize it. We presented it to all our oversight bodies. We actually have multiple oversight bodies. We took it out to the public. We incorporated input. We took it to our DOS commission. We took it to the Board of Supervisors as part of our budget hearing in June. And I think our director Kelly Dierman, as well as Paulo, does have met with every supervisor. To meet with them one-on-one and talk through what we're up to and what this report looks like. This report was really valuable during a very difficult budget season, making the case to elected officials as to what the harm is if we're going to cut funding to one of the largest population groups in the city. Again, our target population is over 200,000 people. So we're talking 1 in 4 people in the city is potentially eligible for DOS services. So then the other thing we do is we're going to use this next year is when we come up with our plan to really kind of focus funding in certain areas. And we've only worked with a certain amount of the data of what we have. So, you know, we may choose to, we're kind of talking internally about focused analyses on any subgroups or specific issues to do a deeper dive into that on that. So. Okay.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. So we are going to actually start our break, and I think we have to come back because we're not going to have a presentation.
No, I sent you an email. You'd like to see, you wanted to zoom in? I know, I was like, oh, little belly pick. I love it. See if he's still there. See if our friend is with him. Yep. There he is. Let's get yours up here.
Your trip. Yeah.
It's a swamp back there. That's a swamp. That's horrible. Thanks, Mike.
Example.
Well, yeah, it's my mom. That's like, I don't know. But you were a human interview, not human. That's an interview.
Yeah, it's a
you've actually had two human to draw I don't like keep that against the link. It's good. Can I give that to the that's all for it? That's why I don't care for the human pot. That's the only good thing about my mom living in the desert. They're actually not going to be a human area. In Alaska, in the heat in the heart of the summer, which is August, the mosquitoes are like mosquito eaters, but they don't think them they're actual mosquitoes. They're Alaska. Soy sauce in there, did you?
No.
Very good.
No.
I like the beach and
Challenging, because I think it'll be hard to do that. So I saw two directors and then suddenly and then the
that's a good person.
I'm This particular presentation, Bill did a version of it for the HHS side back in January. looking at aspects of what is kind of going on from a national perspective, a local perspective, and a little bit of what's going on for this state. So the intent of this presentation, for me, it's not identical to what Bill was doing, but I'm hoping it's more of a compliment to what Bill shared out. I'm hoping there's no surprises here. I feel like if there was something that we put up here and we were surprised, we wouldn't be doing a real good good enough job with regards to letting you know what we're doing in the community health equity promotion branch or HIV prevention activities. So just to put it out there, I want to set the bar low. There should be hopefully no surprises. And in some ways, this is a summary of what you've heard and kind of experienced over the last few years and obviously in the last 12 months with regards to what's kind of trending in the work that we all do. That being said, I did also, from a formatting standpoint, I wanted to look a little bit at the epi, so I'll go through that with a relatively quick pace. Want to look at kind of what has trended in the past that we no longer talk about. That's a short list. Things that happened in the past but are still trending, things that might be kind of a future trend or things that are basically kind of the moment for us now. I kind of, putting this presentation together, I started to get a little bit, started to perseverate or spin around. It's like that past trend, is it a current trend? And I'm like, okay, that's not the intent of the presentation. It's the more the larger picture. So you may see something that's up here and be like, oh, that's actually something that's historic and something that I would consider current. I'm always happy. It's just perspective. So I just wanted to put it out there that none of this is etched in stone. And the idea is to get the larger essence of what's going on. And specifically also trying to make sure that we kind of talk about local, state, and national efforts. The other piece of this is trying to add in a perspective of what Chet's doing around that trend. And you'll see a slide that will have a box on the bottom of it. And I tried to kind of lift up some of the work that might be relevant to what is happening around that particular trend. So let's go through a little bit of the data. This is just a national picture. And I think most folks are familiar with the fact that it's specifically around HIV. Things have moved towards the south and that trend keeps happening. And Bill was mentioning earlier, just with regards to the shifting of funds, the fact that HIV, at least care dollars are kind of moving in that direction, due to the fact that the epidemic is, there's a greater disparity happening in the South. This is just a little bit of data with regards to who is being impacted. I'm not gonna go through the level of details, but the disparities around age, race, specifically for African-Americans and Latinos, and folks who are multi-race as well are pretty evident within this field, within this graph. Feel free to ask me questions as I go along. I'm getting a pace that's a little bit too fast. So the EPI report is available online. We get a presentation. We'll probably get one in October when we do our voting components. I think if anything, kind of the fact that the red line is kind of the indication of new HIV cases in the city. And the fact that this is, the trend basically is this leveling off energy that is happening in the last 5 years. So we definitely had kind of a steeper decline, and then we now have that trend of a flat experience. With neighborhoods, this is what's going on. It was interesting that he kind of mentioned District 11, which is over here, and I noticed it's some of the other graphs that I looked at, that particular area as well has got more hotspots happening, which surprised me. For Hep C, similar components with regards to the number of new infections in 2024 with people who have renewed were 566. So we kind of think the HIV number was 140. The difference that's happening within that. The epidemiology and some bigger pictures with regards to who is having a higher impact of that position. Are those individuals listed there? the STI efforts with regards to declining chlamydia, gonorrhea, and early syphilis as well are dropping from the standpoint, which is a good thing to see. Specifically, though, by neighborhoods, again, this the hotspots kind of look a little bit familiar with regards to chlamydia, gonorrhea, and early syphilis.
Another question.
Sure.
So do you think some of those areas are because there's more concentration of testing, or do you find there's testing throughout the whole city that would indicate the increased rates?
So just to be fair, I think you're pretty clear that they are me because I'm easy on the eyes.
You can believe that.
Yeah.
She's our choke joker.
I've got that. So I can take a guess at that, but specifically, I mean, I've been doing this work for a minute, and we do a lot of testing.
Okay.
So someone who's recently pregnant, they get a lot of chat, there's a lot of screening happening in the city of San Francisco. So I've never seen a blip kind of come up just due to your fact that we've all of a sudden really got into the community of the test. So, but that again, just an observation and not necessarily. And did you have a but I like the I get that question often actually. It's like, oh, is there this reservoir of disease within this community that we're missing? I've never seen that. Keep that going. I know overdose deaths are not necessarily our charge, for lack of a better word, but the fact that we do such significant work with HIV and Hep C prevention within a very similar community, I always want to make sure that it's present for us. In CHEP, I don't know if you feel sometimes we'll include it, sometimes we won't, just based on the fact that there are multiple reasons, depending on the audience and, unfortunately, the politics as well of what's going on. So, but I wanted to make sure that it's included in this particular report. And just kind of acknowledging that the rates have dropped, but there's still, you know, for 2025, 621 is pretty significant with regards to number of years lost, as the epidemiologist who'd like to kind of look at things from that perspective. This is a little bit more granular data with regards to who's being impacted. I won't go through it, but I always want to make sure that folks have a understand that this doesn't impact all communities in the same way. Okay, so now kind of moving into that, we've kind of got the background with regards to what those current diseases look like. Things that are kind of past trends that I've noticed. So the workforce development capacity building. I know that folks, with regards to the recent local cuts, there was a lot of energy around this particular outcome or this activity just due to the fact that there was a priority to make sure that direct services were not cut. And so some of the early cutting that did happen was around workforce development capacity building efforts. Prevention with positives is a term that is just kind of not shared out in the same way that it used to be. When I was working on this bill, kind of acknowledged that at least in the city though, we do use you equals you. And so in some ways it's kind of morphed into going from prevention to positive into that particular terminology. And then the past trend was, I did feel as if we could predict what was going on with our funding landscape. And at this particular moment, I personally don't, I can't, it's there's just a lot more variability than there ever has been for me personally and a lot of my coworkers in the department. Bill was my ghostwriter on a lot of these slides, so feel free to chime in. Well, I made the slides. I'm going to be a little bit conservative because, you know, trendy neutral or whatever, a city of land, and Bill's just like, threw it on. All right, we're going for it. So, All right, so trends from last, trends in the past, But locally, we still want to make sure that we're committed to them. So on a national level, this was, I got a little bit complicated with social determinants, health, DEI, gender ideology, criminalization of street-based services, and services for trans communities. These are all things that nationally are definitely under a lot of scrutiny. Locally, we are still trying to do what we can to make sure that those things are addressed. And part of what that looks like is the fact that we still do have HRTI, although it has been renamed. We can talk more about that. But Latinos is an annual conference for monolingual Spanish-speaking people who serve the monolingual Spanish-speaking communities. This particular conference this year was really powerful, and it had a significant success due to the fact that we were able to create a space for individuals to come together and speak about what was going on to the clients that they serve, and personally how that impacts them as a service provider, just due to the fact that they're also absorbing a lot of that trauma, and then also still trying to remain a service provider. Onboard SF, it will happen in a couple of weeks as well, so that's another opportunity. The health access points still center around the communities that have high disparities with regards to HIV, and then support of gender health services within the department. Is this format work? Is this helpful? Okay. This is where I'm going. This is a transition slide with regards to topics. So the syndemic approach, we've been using this for a little bit. We continue to use it with regards to kind of our movement forward. I do kind of want to acknowledge HHS and CHEP. The CDC kind of took the funds, and we had ETE funding and our core funding. And in this particular cycle, it's like two puzzle pieces. They put them together. They're not completely blended, but they are kind of one unit at this particular point. For HHS, they're two separate pieces for the most part still. So there's a little bit of challenge with regards to the fact that the prevention dollars have been a little bit further merged down the road, and the HHS funds have not. So it's not a bad thing. It's just kind of acknowledging our structure is kind of existing for us.
Because it's built into the legislation, so
that's separate.
For all, you know, whether if it goes through first to have, whether it's EHG or right program, it has to be the person of the regular day. It's a little tiny session, but it's small. So we are limited to working with folks that are HIV positive. It doesn't mean we don't look at all of these syndemics.
Yeah.
Whereas the CDC money is totally your HIV status doesn't matter. So I mean, the services you get. So it's the problem is no one has a clinical appetite to follow the legislation on reauthorization. So this legislation is now 15 years old. So that works. It's not a tough to be an HIV.
It's the legislation has to change. But I have found it difficult to work with sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody laughed.
Yeah, we're waiting to know here. Yeah, okay, let's do this business.
You know, it's a little bit
trying to find the towns.
There you go.
It's not funny.
All right. okay. So working closer with the HHS folks. Yeah. We support the various planning bodies as well. This is just a little bit of a background slide with regards to the structure for the CPS 24047 cycle with regards to what we're in. Test, treat, prevent, respond, core surveillance and community engagement activities are all deliverables that we have in that particular contract. This is just a visual with regards to the syndemic approach that we use here in the city, and kind of these core, what we call building blocks, are the expectations that the health access points do more than just sexual health and drug user health activities, but they make a space that's more of a community center. Then, I mean, I think it's a COE kind of original model, but just kind of judged up a little bit for the prevention activities. All right, so long-acting injectables, something that started a bit ago, but it definitely seems to be getting some beat. Bill announced earlier in the updates with regards to the fact that we have a new DPH kind of champion that's been hired to help with. So we have Andrea Gross, who is presented to this particular body on the long-acting injectables for care aspects, and Olivia, who I haven't even met yet, is coming on board with regards to doing a similar activity for prevention and PrEP access for long-acting injectables. So we're hoping that a little extra kind of commitment to this particular interaction, specifically with regards to equity and people who might have not have the stability to take medications daily or move around or things get lost, that this could be a really significant intervention, and we want to lean into that as hard as possible. DoxyPEP, with regards to the prevention of chlamydia and syphilis, is definitely been something that took off a little while ago, and at the same time, I feel like it's still not fully engaged and has not been, what's the word I want, drama?
Uptake.
I was like, almost there, Laura. Uptake with regards to full engagement with regards to this. But you did see that in the data for the STIs that there was significant drop off, and we think that this is one of the more one of the reasons that is happening. So just to put that out there with regards to all of your world, hopefully folks will continue to engage in it. Our telemedicine efforts, and then our kind of mail components. We have a good sex campaign, and people can gain access to testing supplies through the mail. And again, this particular we're using these funds to reach African Americans and Latinos, specifically all members of those populations, not just the LGBT or people who use drugs components. Cluster detection and response. We have a presentation every couple of years to this particular body. This is still out there. I was a little bit surprised when all the DOGE stuff happened. Earlier in the year, I really thought this would be one of the things that they just took out real quick, and they did not. So I was like, that was interesting. Here in San Francisco, we do not see a lot of clusters, kind of based on what you just said, Lee, your question earlier. This is specifically around HIV, but for the other diseases as well. It's always helpful to kind of have it in the background, though, so if we ever do get a cluster, that we can respond and that we'll be quickly aware that there is a cluster developing within the city. Any questions about any of this? Mpox. So we have done really well in regards to the fact that there are almost no cases. There's always a little bit of blip after Dory, Folsom, and Pride. So I'm not sure what happens at those events, but
sometimes. And I'll talk to you about that offline.
So, we just want to make sure that if people do not have vaccination and then they are potentially within the population that might have high risk, that they get vaccinated. And then the fact that there was a CLAB 1, which is the more dangerous component, there was a confirmed case in people with that individual. So but that was a little bit ago. So hopefully that is did not carry forward. So just the fact that we're expanding medications for people who are using drugs, and the fact that we want to make sure that we continue to lean into reducing the barriers and making sure that people have access to whatever intervention works for them is also the department's commitment. And so we continue to do that. So it's just a little bit of data with regards to that was presented by Emily. Ragnall. To this body a few months ago with regards to access to human This is a little bit of data with regards to the overdoses of these particular substances that folks found in folks' systems at the time of overdose. Mm-hmm. Unstable funding. So this is just a I don't think I really need to say this, and at the same time, prior to this last 12 months, it felt like the formula for us, and specifically where we put money, Bill mentioned this as well, with its shifting funds from certain CBOs to others, is we would kind of see that our CDC dollars was something that potentially would flux,
and at our local general fund, something that we could always make sure was stable. And kind of the opposite happened for us this year. So our CDC funding was, it didn't fluctuate a lot, but in the end, we ended up getting the same amount, if not a little bit more. It was a hellish ride with regards to not understanding what was going on versus the federal landscape. And then the fact that we were kind of cut off our regards to the fact that general funds went through a more significant cut, and that is just different for us. And so that being said, that's what's going forward with us at this particular point. Does that make sense? Is that kind of a fair summary? Great.
Little bit on California. So I think one of the other significant things that kind of happened with California is just the fact that
they have a significant amount of money from the I won't say the ad backs, but that's
rebate fund.
And that has just changed our relationship with them, not in a bad way, but in the fact that Marissa Ramos, now that she's got that position as a endemic division chief, has always been a close ally and has really worked well with us. It's been nice to the fact that we had that relationship in place prior to those funds being around, and now that they are in place, that I know the Second Wave Foundation and the ET Community Advisory Board, I don't know what I call that.
Coalition
have been really working closely with the state of California around multiple issues, but that funding is one of them.
Bill, I actually put this in blue because you made a comment, and I remember you made a comment, and I was like, oh, I can never say that. I was like, oh, I'll put that in blue. Do you remember what the comment was? Because I can't remember at the moment. I'm putting you on the spot, sorry. No, don't worry about it.
You can go back.
Thank you.
It's
okay.
Take a second question.
Sure. And then just the planning body that TJ and I have served on for a while now with the various TJ's on 108 at the moment. TJ. Sorry, my
dyslexia. There's eight TJ, but
I was like,
I don't think you can have nothing wrong with dyslexia comes through.
Yeah. It's just a really good example of my life. Lexia presents. So sorry about that. Great. Okay. So another transition slide. So I think I have like four or five slides left. So just kind of acknowledge it near the end. But just the demonization of non-traditional gender norms, services, and the elimination of funds for trans-focused and gender-affirming services. Reality with regards to what has happened specifically around trans individuals and their ability to have certain rights in the US. And so, unfortunately, that trend is present. And I'll stop. The increased surveillance and deportation of immigrants through ICE and other venues, as well as the restriction and elimination of services to non-documented individuals. So this particular thing has definitely impacted folks accessing services, walking through the streets, and the ability to kind of take care of themselves in a way that has been unprecedented in my lifetime. Reproductive health and the criminalization of the ability for individuals to choose their rights. With regards to what's going on in the courts and access to services. This is definitely impacting San Francisco as well with regards to Planned Parenthood being as present as they were previously. The elimination of basically research studies on a significant level, so this has been gutted in many significant ways with regards to that we have the ability to keep up-to-date research, and that landscape has changed. So this.
If you quickly go to the apps, you can end on the comment that I had made just was that you guys have been dealing with years of funding uncertainty with the CDC and the talks of moving to block grants at the state level and really kind of huge cuts to it. So you guys have certainly done the role in terms of And really with the help of Hackett and others to make sure that there wasn't a decrease in funding. And it does look like now there is also an increased role on depending on general fund, but also it looks like at least for the next 5 years, hopefully that the part B, yeah, we make funds will shore up.
All right, so the health access points just kind of acknowledged prior. We actually had 13 building blocks. And what we did in this particular cycle is we reduced it down to 8. All the services are still the same. We just wanted to reduce the administrative burden on the folks that we were funding. And at the same time, we kind of reduced the terminology around the term harm reduction and making sure that those services were encapsulated in this particular just give the politics and what's going on there and the direction that we can get. So this particular one is specifically with regards to the fact that we changed the Harm Reduction Training Institute to the Health and Recovery Training Institute, part of which acknowledging what's going on within the department at the particular moment and the politics within the city. Acknowledgements with regards to what Bill was saying earlier was the happened on the CBOs, community members, people showing up to the supervisors meetings and sharing public comment. And the I will hand it to the health commission listening to folks and hearing what they had to say and changing decisions that it previously made with regards to some of the cuts that were coming down was nice to see. And the role of the Ending the Epidemics Committee on a national level. What Laura was mentioning earlier, I'm not sure where I missed it, with regards to the CDC did impact community organizations that were funded in the state. And we got a email from our project officer saying we'd be interested in opening up our funding cycle to account for the money that was being cut directly to the CBOs. And we were a little bit confused with regards to why we did that. We didn't understand the what had happened to the supervision that was directly funded. So we have. I'm not quite sure how transparent I can be about where you're at within that process, but we are within a process with regards to trying to do what we can to address the current state.
Essentially, the CDC was completely untransparent. So there are two main large grant cycles where the CDC gives money directly to community-based organizations for high impact HIV prevention. Within San Francisco, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation is funded with one of those, and San Francisco Community Health Center is funded with a different cycle. The CDC has been, it's one of those things that's hard to know if it's malevolence or incompetence or both, but they just like, the whole cycle should have been renewed as of July 1 of this year. And they kept just not telling us what was gonna happen. Not issuing a new notice of funding availability. And even the program officers that we spoke with at the CDC didn't know, he didn't have any information. And often they would indicate to us that they had been told they could not talk to us about it, for example. They eventually they gave us a 3-month extension, but then they just told us the grant was ending. What they didn't tell either the CBOs around the country or the health departments around the country, they were then actually taking that money and handing it over to the health departments With no, just saying, here's some extra money, spend it however you want, not communicating that this was money that had previously been invested in community-based organizations. And so somebody, you know, some of the advocates of the National Association of State Territorial AIDS Directors figured that out. They started communicating that. And so some health departments, like San Francisco Health Department, immediately reached out to us, to SNCHC, to say, how can we sort this out? Other health departments are just like, it's ours now, you know, like we don't need the community-based organizations. And I think the biggest impact is going to be on the smallest community-based organizations, right? That don't have enough, you know, reserve and money to be able to, you know, go for 3 months longer, or don't have the ability to advocate with their state health departments. And those, you know, we know what the landscape of HIV organizations looks like. Those are almost inevitably the smaller, like, community of color-based organizations, trans-led organizations, right? It's the, those are the organizations that are not going to be able to make it through all of this funding instability, and we will be losing some of the most, you know, like, most rooted in community organizations, I think, across the whole country. And I think that, honestly, I think that's part of what their intent is to kind of like, you know, starve out these smaller organizations and the ones that really come out of the community. And even with what the money that they give to the health department is, that only goes through spring of next year. That's not another 5 years of funding, which is what, you know, ordinarily this should have been another cycle of 5 years of funding for high impact HIV prevention. And our, you know, at SFAF, it helps support PrEP and PrEP access at STRUT. SFCHC's is trans and youth.
So you mentioned that finally,
was there any rationale given, or was it just
no rationale given? Changing priorities at the federal level. That's the best we can.
I don't know if you either.
Rationale feels clear. What would be a satisfying answer to that?
Yeah, like, I mean, sometimes there's a rational given, sometimes it's not.
Exactly. This one is changing funding priorities.
I was told it and I didn't hear a rationale, which is like it stopped, and then Laura kind of mentioned it was supposed to happen a bit ago, so it's hard to jumpstart something after it stopped.
So you mentioned that there, like, these foundation has that lawsuit. Will any of this be
That is a good question. So our lawyers who are representing us and SFCHC in the lawsuit said they don't. And we're having this conversation with the state office of AIDS as well. Like, because the CDC didn't, it's a contract, a grant set, 5 year grant cycle that ended. But like SFAM was set for like 15 years or something. And they just didn't issue a new notice of funding availability. And so there's less to say that it's a legal issue. Like, they're not cutting a grant mid-cycle. They're, you know, they've tried that too, right? And that's where we've been able to push back on things where they try to cut it mid-cycle. This one, they're just like, oh, well, ran out.
I think the other piece, just kind of up in that, the acknowledgement on a national level, these funds historically were for community-based organizations that might be in a community, in a part of the U.S. that was not necessarily friendly to the populations that we care about. So they were able to fund that kind of queer organization within Alabama without the locals caring about, you know, without the locals having any control. So it's kind of tragic that was the initial intent of the directly funded CDC entities, and now it backfired in regards to what we're trying to make sure that is stabilized or continued in regards to access to services.
So I'm just curious, there's no language like in a contract that says, like, if we're going to end this Monday, we'll give you guys 2 years notice or a year notice or,
no, I mean, it was a like a grant, multi-year grant cycle, and ordinary, like pre-Trump administration CDC practice was, you know, as one grant cycle ended, you know, some like 6 to 9 months before it ended, they would send out a new notice and everyone would apply for it. And sometimes they fund slightly different groups. I mean, it's the same thing that, you know, the San Francisco Department of Public Health does, and often you end up funding the same programs because they're effective and they're working and they build up the infrastructure and everything. And this time, you know, it has been creating a lot of anxiety among our finance folks at the very least, because there's been no communication and nothing and no indication as to when they were going to issue the, you know, the request for proposals and what it was going to look like. We were also very worried that it was going to have language in it that was incompatible with our values as an organization about, like, you can have this money, you can't serve trans people or something like that. You know, so we had a lot of, yeah, people have been very stressed about it for the last, like, 9 months, and then, yeah, it's gone.
Do you anticipate, I appreciate the dialogue, but I also at the same time want to follow the process so you don't,
Sure. So just for you guys to know, both the CDC is likely not to continue to exist. The services are likely to roll into Make America Healthy again. Under, we don't know which can be there. And also, PRSA Hab is likely to roll up also into the same line. So that the work going forward will be to Laura's point, was it intentional or was it just a lack of organization infrastructure? We don't think that in the CDC, so it's very incredible staffing. So it's a little hard to tell, but I do think the work going forward would be a lot of both education and advocacy as this new organization emerges to take care of business. And I think both on the care and prevention side, that will be next year's not time high to make sure that the funding goes where it needs to go.
Yeah, and just the administrative burden of trying to, for us to try to take these funds internally and then get them back out. You know, we're a health department, nothing happens that agilely. So, and I can only imagine for other local health jurisdictions where they're probably just getting good. Like there may have been a political ally within the system, but the system was just not agile enough to actually, and we're still in process of part of where I'm like, I still want to make sure, not 100% sure that we're agile enough, so we're doing what we can. You sure, John? Any other questions? So were there any anything missing from all of you with regards to, I feel like you are a community of experts with regards to these particular fields. Was there anything that's happened in the last year that you feel was not kind of covered in this training that you're like, Thomas, you forgot law or great. So you know,
I just would say this to acknowledge that at one point we thought we might be shrinking in. And this is the new trend is every year we don't know, we get partial information, and yet we endure, and the system endures, and in some ways actually different. So I think it's really important, even in very difficult times, to not reach back over what actually is happening. And I don't think that's because of passivity, I think people push back. And I know sometimes it feels futile, but recently just watching what happened with what they tried to do, they made out in Florida and they lost big. So it's just to say, I think part of the strategy is believing in the role of advocacy and keeping it cool. And so we need to wait up on that.
Great message forward.
Just one comment I wanted to, in reference to California trends, I just wanted to lift up Dr. Marissa Ramos's hiring. At the California Department of Public Health, they decided to combine the STI viral hepatitis branch with the HIV AIDS branch. Marissa has been, Dr. Ramos has been heading up the HIV, the State Office of AIDS. She he's now overseeing all of it. And I think that this is an excellent thing. I mean, I have really appreciated working with her. She is, sometimes you get people in those positions that really have a heart for working with the community, and sometimes you don't. And she's been someone who's been really, really great to work with, has been, you know, willing to answer all of our questions and technical assistance requests as advocates, and really, you know, partnered as closely as she can. So I think it, you know, the state is this weird bright spot in between the horrors of the federal and local administration. And I think, you know, regardless of who's governing next year, you know, both that we have funding at the state level for HIV services, and we've got solid leadership for HIV services. You know, I think we're going to be in better shape because of that, even if, you know, we've got these Trumpian, Orwellian, you can say harm reduction stuff happening at the local level, and it's not still one of the most effective HIV prevention interventions we've got going. So,
glad you said that.
I'll stop there on the edit for
I can't believe they're hiring you just because, you know, rather than your brain I think is more beautiful.
It just sounds like that.
That was really hard for me to say, but.
Right, we're going to hear from Mark about the HER Summit.
Okay, got it. Great. Hi, this shouldn't be new to any of you, but I'm going to do it once a year. Okay. With that exciting intro, we'll try to turn frowns upside down, talking about what's exciting and awesome about the council, which is the community council. It's a total rarity amongst all federal funding. You, the community, get to actually choose how to spend funds for now. It's something important and something that actually was built up by the community itself. So, you know, when all this bad news comes to you from the Fed and even a little bit from local, just keep in mind you're part of the council that actually take care of business. So with that said, we'll do a review of our legislative mandate, stuff that we're supposed to do. Which I can figure out how to do this. Okay, let's just try this one. Okay, there we go. Your roles and responsibilities as a council member are to development needs. We're really doing that right now. We're in the very end. We only have four left. We spent about 2 years doing it. A little bit, a year longer than I thought it would be. But then, hey, our EMP will be all fresh by the time this year ends, and we'll be able to vote on it come January. A little bit of a spoiler, there is going to be a shift in term limits, just for those who haven't been to steering. Term limits were recommended to be solidified, I'd say, by our person monitors of yesteryear. Where are they now? So the term limits will be 3 years and then one renewal. So still last quite a long time. After those 6 years, if you want to remain, you can come back. You'll be on hiatus for like 6 months. During that time period, if you're a lifer, you're more than welcome to come to our council meetings and speak, and you always do. You won't be a member. All right, so P&P, that's one of them. Assess needs, we'll talk more about that later, but we assess needs in multiple ways, including the way that we just saw with Mike Zoll. Community needs assessment. We do comprehensive planning. That's something that Leroy has Leroy presented on quite recently, two times actually this year, on our comprehensive plan that's happening here and on state level. We've also received some updates with the consulting. We ensure coordination with other Ryan White and HIV related services. So that means we like to get other different sorts of people here on the council, like folks from behavioral health. We did have someone from OZP, right? Peace, and Okay. We assess the administrative mechanism. The administrative mechanism is, of course, the grantee. Who is the grantee? Oh, come on, I ask this like every year. Don't answer Bill. Bill, stop giving a hint. Who is the grantee? It's not us. Thank you. You win. Wow, guys. So the grantor is FIRSA. They grant funds to the grantee, which is the education. Keep that in mind, because we literally got dinged because we were asked about the grantee assessment, and the people in the monitor were like, grantee what? So please, you all need to know that, because we have surprises for monitors. They can appear at any moment.
You just stopped every meeting with a
yeah.
It's just not a term.
It's a term they use. They're the boss.
Yeah.
All right. So, develop standards of care.
Well, to add in, they contribute the word recipient.
You're
going to
have
to
get this.
Yeah.
I already heard people say. So sorry. Thank you. We'll write
down a poster for all of you. But before, maybe we'll do Mark did a great job today. Maybe we'll put an next schedule site in there.
Absolutely. We'll do a retreat. We'll get a retreat. Standards of care, something else that we actually share oversight with DPH, the grantee. This is something that can be led by the council or can be led by DPH. Either way, it has to be run through the other. Well, the most recent one was done actually by our fantastic grant writer, Robert Worry. For many years, he came by via Zoom and actually represented all of our updated standard of care and best practices. You know, we can do this again maybe another year or two. And then we do our main event, which is to set priorities and allocate resources. Resources are what?
Money,
right. One of my party dollars, exactly. So we do both. We have other responsibilities as well. Those are the main things. Everything that we do throughout the year is actually to lead us to priority and setting and resource allocation. Even if we choose to keep things the same, it should be considered an informed vote. All these presentations are to help inform you on making your decision, and that decision is exactly why this council exists. Okay. Conflict of interest. If you are a service provider, please raise your hand. All right, service providers have a potential conflict of interest if their agency receives or could receive Ryan Mark Part A funds. A conflict of interest is no problem. Consumers don't have it, either do actually nowadays they consider government to have it too. So consumers don't have it, period. Service providers deal with conflict of interest by recusing themselves from votes. We very rarely vote in a specific service category, but say if we were to vote on a specific service category that was something that existed at your agency, you would have to recuse yourself from that vote. Simple as that. We do slate votes. In slate votes, we will often vote for all different kinds of service categories all at the same time. When we do that, your recusal from your conflict of interest is understood. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Conflict of interest also exists. I don't know why it's so hard for me. For folks who are on boards of directors for those particular impacted agencies. They do not exist for clients who are on client advisory panels. The main issue here is money. So, I'm just trying to scroll down. You know, pretty basic, like granting. Should I just give that up? Should I stop haranguing? There's been some confusion in the past. The main thing is money. So, if your decision as a board member or a staff member could lead to your agency getting more money, and therefore perhaps your salary getting bigger, or the salary of your colleagues getting bigger, that's a conflict of interest. That's what it's all about, is money. All right, developing standards of care and evaluating services is another thing. I mentioned that already. It's a we share a collaborative mandate, and that's the DPH. We can always update, and updates can look like a lot of different things, in particular just what clinical standards might be, which target population, which actual modalities exist within those standards. Now, we should be doing those with people who are not only experiencing those services, but who are providing them to if we decide to update. Next. Okay, just a minute. Cat, I'm so late. Okay, that's I feel like we skipped a lot. Pull out your documents. Plan Council Sports Staff.
Your who?
We pull out this, please. Okay. Planning Council supports that. So we have 3 point something. The point something is Allie Cohn, who we met. She helped with the reunion project, so we helped with granting the assessment on the Planning Council support contract. Also includes me, your program director of council support, Kat and Kira. Kira, of course, is in charge of our needs assessment. Kat helps out with that and is in charge of our website. Thank you, Kat. Our contract comes out of the slice that is no more than 18-10% that's administration. So when you pay for us, you're not taking money away from the service. You're taking money away from the building. All right.
No, just to be clear that it's there's a 10% cap on administrative costs. There's an additional 5% cap or expected on CQI at 85%. Discuss those services. So the work that Shanti does, usually valuable, is part of the initiative. We're happy to take that.
All right. Assess needs. As I mentioned, we look at a lot of different things throughout the year. So we assess needs in different ways. We assess needs, of course, through our targeted needs assessment. Other jurisdictions will often just do a sort of a global needs assessment. We have so many people here in San Francisco that we found that information is fairly useful today. With so many people and so many different populations having different challenges. So what we do here in Pretty San Francisco, we have targeted needs assessment. So that means a community engagement committee every year chooses a particular population or community to target for needs assessment. So this year is, can anyone tell me what it is? Immigrants, for people of immigrant parents. We also have focus groups, they're called FOLAs, community outreach and listening activities. Those are often the targets that aren't number one. And so they'll be discussing a lot of different targets, and the one that folks decide on would be the target assessment, which we hope to get between 50 to 75 people. And then all the other topics, we don't want to lose them because they are important, will become much smaller focus groups. These calls could be from 4 to 12 people. Our most recent one was for cisgender women. We also assess needs by receiving a lot of different reports throughout the year, as I mentioned. Perhaps most importantly, our former area report, now what? HCC and also our EPI report. Friends that have met the genealogy. All right, moving on to assessing the efficiency of the administrative mechanism. Again, who's the administrative mechanism?
No.
We assess them in two ways, as you can see here in the slide. There's one major way, which is like, well, how do they treat their service provider? Are they paying them on time? Are there RFPs fair? They're doing a good job with the system of care. We ask the actual service providers. You go to Happen, we have a survey, we do some one-on-one interviews. We also interview with some EPH staff. The second part is, how are they supporting the council? Are they good faith partners? As big partners. So we consulted with a few different council members, and we did get some feedback during our last monitoring that we're actually consulting with a few council members. When we asked about DPH, they want to consult all of you. So that feels good. We asked about DPH, how they're actually doing here with the council meetings. Be honest. All right, next slide. I've actually, this is the one that I jumped ahead to, so it's going to be longer. To set priorities and allocate resources, which is the slide after. So there's different things. As I mentioned, the main thing, if you're getting this information throughout the year, you are not getting it right before you vote. You're not getting it at the meeting that you vote. That would be super irresponsible. That's actually what we used to do. We don't do that anymore. We take a lot of specific needs into consideration, like I mentioned, needs assessment, but also like which service categories are serving which clients, so what is their cost utilization, where are they in the city, what's the spread. You can get all that information out of my personal favorite presentation of the year, service summary. After a year, you should hold on to that presentation if you want to know literally what the service categories are, who they serve, and how many, as well as their challenges.
And
all right.
Many of that will be presented or co-presented by Natalie or the AR function.
I'm looking forward to my favorite presentation. All right. We always target underserved communities. Underserved communities can be multiple different kinds of communities. They can be based around ethnicity, they can be based around gender, communication around income, of course. We do this through our severe need and special population definition. Those are kinds of eligibility criteria, particular registers, in particular our Centers of Excellence model. All right, and we also want to make sure that things work together. We are, you might have forgotten, we're actually a merged council. So that means that CARE merged with what council?
Prevention.
Who's our prevention representative? Our officially designated prevention representative on this council?
We're,
no.
It's too much.
Thomas is our representative. That's actually one of the last designations that seems he gave us before they voted.
Is this a B plus on our end?
B plus? What do you mean?
A B plus?
Just granted, you guys? You guys will definitely see at this point. It's been like so many things. Remember my quiz last year? I hate the quiz responses that you all did last year, like when I'm teachers. A lot of times I do that. Except for TJ. TJ was excellent, so was Manuel.
You need to start putting these questions on the meeting evaluation.
Okay, we're almost wrapped up here. I'm sure you're tired of this. All right, so the second to last slide, 75-25. So in the mandate that 75% of our services go to core services. Core services are those that are medical or medically associated. So that means something like medical case management. It also means something like medical services or ambulatory care, primary care, whatever you want to call it. 75% has to go to that, 25% can go to support services. And so I'll give you an example of what are support services. What's one of our support service categories?
Food,
exactly. One of our most highly rated by consumers support service categories. Being a support service category doesn't mean it's less than, which is different, it's not necessarily executive. However, it is seen as very important that most of these services go to services that are medically connected. That's why it's 75. However, if the jurisdiction can put forward the idea that they have funds, say general funds or other kinds of funds that are enough to actually support their core services, they can ask for a waiver if they need to do a little bit more to support services than 25%. And we have asked for waivers. I think we get them all the time. So last but not least, our last slide is the actual relationship with our wonderful good faith partners, the grantee TPA, represented by Jay Lowe. We provide directives to the VPH, even though we are partners, that's important for you all to understand. You have an actual mandate with actual authority. You are the ones who actually determine how much money goes to each service category, how they should actually be prioritized, as well as the ins and outs of that service category through your shared oversight or standards of care. So be happy about that. It's actual authority for that. All right. Any questions?
No, I'd just like to add that, you know, the substantial portion of what we prioritize and allocate comes from the general fund, and the city allows us to prioritize and allocate those as well.
Yeah, and I would think the city, I would think specifically our partner at BPH. There are other jurisdictions where they don't place all lines together, actually, and they know that, because that can tell you that the relationship, if you've been on the long enough, you know that this company had that kind of relationship. But for at least, I'd say, 20 years now, it's been going well. So much thanks to Bill. Actually, I'd like to end this with just thanking Bill for all the different things that we've done. I mean, it's been too bad.
Yeah.
All right.
Greg, Mr. Mark. Right. So the next meeting is going to be on Monday of this week. There are 8 people in the meeting.